This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
A warning, this episode contains discussion of sexual assault. This year's nominees for the Oscar for Outstanding Documentary Feature are really strong entries. They're all streaming, and they're very much worth checking out for yourself. I'm Linda Holmes, and today on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, we're talking about this year's Oscar nominees for Documentary Feature and where to watch them.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Noom. Noom's first-ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, helps you build new habits for a healthier lifestyle. Check out The Noom Kitchen for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Mattress Firm. To feel energized this spring, you need quality sleep. To achieve quality sleep, you need the right mattress. Mattress Firm will help you find the right bed to improve your sleep with their wide selection of quality mattresses at every price. Plus, if you see a lower price, Mattress Firm will match it. The right mattress matters, and Mattress Firm will find yours during the Friends and Family Sale. Shop in-store or online at mattressfirm.com. Restrictions apply.
Joining me today is my co-host, Glenn Weldon. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
It's always good to be here together in Oscar season. So the Oscars documentary category, I think, has a reputation of always being really heavy, really sad. But that's actually not always true. Summer of Soul won in this category. 20 Feet from Stardom won in this category. Free Solo won. So there really are often some more upbeat films that are nominated. And that is all as sort of wind up to say this year, I'm not going to lie, they are all pretty heavy. But I found them all really gripping to watch, and not kind of dutifully, but really for what strong films they are. So I want to jump right in. First up is Bobby Wine, The People's President. It's directed by Christopher Sharp and Moses Boeo. And it tells the story of Bobby Wine, a popular musician in Uganda, who was elected to a parliamentary seat and ultimately ran against the longtime president, tried to unite opposition groups to dislodge him from power. This is a film that is streaming on Disney Plus and Hulu. We are really in the era of these things kind of being available, at least a lot of them,
right,
by the time the Oscars happen. What did you think of this one?
Well, my notes here say heartbreaking, but that doesn't tell you anything because that word appears in my notes for all these films. This is the story of a man who suffered so greatly for coming as close as anyone has to ending a really brutal, decades-long authoritarian regime. It ends up being a pretty chilling portrait of how, you know, the tools of the state can and, in fact, are used to prevent change from happening. You know, some would say chilling portrait. Somebody else might say handy how-to guide.
Yeah.
And for that reason, it doesn't feel like it might have felt if you watched this 10, 15 years ago, because this is a National Geographic film. So it might feel like cultural anthropology. You know, oh, look at how those systems, those institutions over there aren't sufficient. No, there is a tremendous urgency and immediacy and really depressing quality to this film, because these filmmakers are on hand as things literally explode, as people get shot. So you don't come away from this with a view of the world that's particularly heartening. And also, not for nothing, I worry that this is going to be to this year what Navalny was last year, yeah. which is a portrait of a very brave activist who should keep his head on a swivel.
Yeah. I appreciated very much the fact, and maybe this is my perspective as much as anything else, but like you said, if you are one of the many people around the world who is worrying about the state of your own democracy and mm-hmm. what it potentially looks like when officially you have one, but in practice you don't, it looks like this.
Yeah.
Not just the fact that nobody has any confidence in the voting and the ballot counting, but also, you know, the imprisoning of activists and, you know, the manipulation of other parts of government by whoever the mm-hmm. leader happens to be. So, you know, it is a very depressing film. At the same time, I also really enjoyed this portrait of him. He's very charismatic. Not sure. surprising. He's a musician. Mm-hmm. I like the fact that this is a portrait of kind of accepting very earnest protest music, which I think is something that a lot of people struggle with. Mm-hmm. If you actually were to put out a song that was about, you know, we are fighting for freedom as he does, that people would find it kind of corny and cheesy. And in this film, it's a really effective piece of protest music.
Galvanizing, yeah. We are fighting for freedom. We are fighting
for freedom. We are fighting for freedom. And I also really think this is an example of how you show the partner of a central figure in a documentary and give them kind of respect, because his wife, mm-hmm. whose name is Barbie, so it's Bobby and Barbie, she is such an interesting person to me because their relationship is obviously really strong and very loving, but nobody shies away from the fact that she has a big part to play in this, and it wasn't necessarily something she chose in the same way that he did. I was a big fan of this one, and when I think about this movie, I find myself thinking like, oh yeah, you know, maybe this is the one that ought to win. So that's where I come down.
I felt that way about each one of them in turn.
I was just going to say, that's kind of going to be my bit here. I think when I get to the yep. end of all these, it's going to be, yeah, this is the one that I think ought to win. So that's Bobby Wine, The People's President, which is streaming on Disney Plus and Hulu. Next up is The Eternal Memory, which is the story of Chilean journalist Augusto Góngora and his wife, Pauli, and their relationship in the years after he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. There aren't interviews in this movie. It's just footage of them mm-hmm. that the director, Maite Alberdi, collected over this period of years. And Alberdi, by the way, directed The Mole Agent, which was nominated in this category a few years ago. The Eternal Memory is streaming on Paramount Plus. Well, Glenn, a tough watch, yes?
A tough watch, yeah. I mean, we talked about this. Both of us have experience with this disease in our families. And so I've had one experience to hollow me out for enough for a lifetime. So, you know, I wasn't looking for another. And also, you know, for me anyway, there have been plenty of Oscar docs and shorts that traffic in a kind of cheery uplift, imposing this. You know, you take a messy human life and you try to impose a narrative on it and you try to give it an ending that people can walk out of the theater feeling good about. That always rubs me the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So for many reasons, this was the last one I watched because I just wasn't ready for
me
it.
Too.
It's the one that I found most charming. Heartbreaking, yeah, but also heartwarming. This couple is so charismatic yeah. and warm. The love between them is palpable. There's a tenderness there. There is an emotional availability that wasn't part of my experience with this disease. I mean, and that affected how I watched it because about halfway in, I was like, people with this disease have good and bad days. And all we're seeing are the good days. That's not true to the experience. And then about halfway through, the bad days start happening. And they were very familiar yeah. just to see her, how determined she is, how, you know, I don't want to call it cheerfulness or positivity because that really diminishes it. This is something bigger. This is like a selflessness that is so, I don't know, it borders on the divine. It is just,
yeah.
you wonder how she can keep going. And then the film captures these moments that I know very well of just lucidity and connection. Mm-hmm. And there's this one moment where he thanks her and it's like, oh, well, there, that's another, he just bought himself another what? Month?
Yeah.
Month of jet. Like, there, that's how you keep going.
And in fact, there's one moment where he is in one of those better days or moments where he's more lucid. And she's telling him how difficult it's been. And she's telling yep. him, you haven't remembered me. Mm-hmm. All day, you haven't mm-hmm. remembered me. You haven't recognized me. And she's crying. And he's comforting her, just like any spouse of any person would comfort them in a difficult moment. And mm-hmm. I also saved it for last. You know, my experience is not specifically with Alzheimer's. It's more with dementia and changes over time. Mm-hmm. But I think if you've ever been through that, like you said, it's just there are these moments where you're like, oh, I agree with you. Her ability to find ways through it, particularly in those early scenes where he, you know, he's having more of the good days. But she will tell him, like, what would you like to hear about? And he'll say, something about us. And she'll tell him a story that he doesn't remember.
Yeah.
And he reacts with delight to these stories mm-hmm. of his life that he doesn't remember. I also saved this one for last. It's not easy, but it's not a wallow.
Yeah.
And it's realistic because, like you said, this is not one you can set up for the will there suddenly be right, an improvement right. in his condition or something like that.
Because again, like you don't impose a narrative here. There's only one narrative. This story can only end one way as the disease progresses. And let me ask you something. There is an attempt on the filmmaker's part to widen out and find echoes of this experience in what I guess you'd call the Chilean national identity. You know, this refusal to acknowledge the fact that over 1,000 people disappeared mm-hmm. during the Pinochet regime. Mm-hmm. And I see exactly why they tried to do that. He was a journalist who covered that regime. But I thought those moments in the film were not clumsy exactly, because nothing about this film is clumsy, but inessential, like an add-on, because this film has a startling intimacy. Mm-hmm. And every time we started to widen away from that, I felt like the filmmakers were not understanding how precious this thing they were focused on was.
I agree with you that it was not the most engaging part of the film for me, which is always when you're with the two of them together. Mm-hmm. But I do think that they are also trying to tell you a broader story of his vibrancy and his accomplishments. And look, this film is at its best when it is the two of them talking to each other. And for those of you who are listening, you know Glenn and I aren't always going to come together and tell you that something is an astonishingly beautiful love story, but it is.
Yep.
It really is. So that is The Eternal Memory, and it is streaming on Paramount Plus. Next up, we have Four Daughters. It's streaming now on Netflix, and it is probably the most formally experimental of these films. The director, Kawther Ben-Hania, tells the story of Olfa, a Tunisian woman who tells us early on that she had four daughters, but two of them are gone. Two of them are still with her. But the device that the director uses is that she films reenactments of important moments in their story using two actresses to play the missing older daughters while the two younger daughters play themselves. There's also an actress who plays Olfa in some scenes, although sometimes Olfa plays herself. So the real documentary subjects have all these very interesting interactions with the women who are playing them as you watch what's kind of it starts to sound so meta, and it's not as weird as it sounds, but it's almost a making of documentary about making these reenactments. And I promise you, if you sit down and watch it, it's less awkward than I'm making it sound. Do you agree?
Sure, absolutely. But it is reenactment, right? And if I grew up at a time when reenactment meant unsolved mysteries, right? meant cheesiness. And so I went in with my arms crossed, but you nailed it. The way it's handled when the subjects interact with the actors who are portraying them or portraying their siblings, giving them pointers, commenting on how alike or not alike they are from the person they're portraying, that is fascinating. The fact that the two younger daughters, as you mentioned, are playing themselves. So, of course, it didn't occur to me until I saw it, but many scenes will become, you know, if you reenact these scenes, it's going to become the kind of reenactment that takes place in therapy. And they comment upon that. I have read some reviews that try to make the case that this never really answers the question of why the two elder daughters became radicalized, as if it ever could, right? As if, like, there's one explanation that unlocks everything. What I think this movie is really about is not the why of radicalization, but the sheer heavy fact of it, like what it does to families.
Right.
And then the performance aspect adds still another layer, like when Olfa is describing and then subsequently reenacting, you know, how an exchange between her and her husband went. Well, it's just her here now. Her husband's not around. So how in the hell do we know that she's telling us the truth? And does it matter if she's telling us the truth, or what really matters is that it's important to her to assert that that's how it went down? It is so messy. I like that the film steers into that messiness as if trying to pretend it doesn't exist. That's how you use reenactment, I think.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting way to tell this story. And one of the things that I really like about it also is that when you begin this film, you kind of feel like maybe you're going to see a story of noble Olfa and the terrible losses that she suffered because two of her daughters have sort of vanished from her life. You don't get that. right? You start to hear Ulfa describe things about her own parenting and her experiences with her daughters, and you start to go, oh, now, wait a minute. You know, nobody is blaming her for the ultimate fate of the family. But at the same time, it's like, wait a minute. You know, her own behavior towards her daughters sometimes seems very regrettable, bordering on abusive. And her two daughters who are in the film feel very free to tell the truth about their experiences with their mom, which are not always entirely positive. So you're not getting a story of purely Ulfa as a person suffering. You're also seeing the complexity of her story and the complexity of her, her relationship with the daughters. But there's these moments where you see the two daughters and the two actresses and Ulfa, and you realize how heavy that feeling is to all of them for there to be, again, this woman and the four daughters, you know? I just think this movie is completely fascinating.
I agree.
All right, so that is Four Daughters, and it's streaming on Netflix. Up next, To Kill a Tiger. To Kill a Tiger is about sexual assault, so be aware of that. It was directed by Nisha Pahuja, and it follows a farmer named Ranjit, who lives in a village in India and is trying to get justice for his daughter, who was sexually assaulted by three men when she was 13. He comes under a tremendous amount of pressure from community leaders, from his neighbors, to compromise, as they put it, and not insist on pursuing a case with the police. But he also has a group of activists and attorneys who are supporting him, working with him to see that the perpetrators are punished. It is worth noting, I think, that there has been some pushback about this film for a few reasons. The filmmaker is based in Canada, which means it's a sort of outsider perspective on this very small community in India. Mm-hmm. And also, you do see Ranjit's daughter, who was a minor when the interviews with her were filmed and when these events were happening. She is over 18 now. She made the decision after she turned 18 to go ahead with appearing in the film. But I think those are all concerns that are good to keep in mind.
Sure.
To Kill a Tiger is streaming starting tomorrow on Netflix. Glenn, what did you think of this one?
Well, I understand the caveats. It's not as if the film is trying to pretend like it is an insider's perspective.
Right.
We see the camera go into the village. We see how everyone in the village regards the camera warily. We see that they've got their guard up. We see that in the beginning, they say the things to the camera that they think the camera wants to hear. But the thing is, you spend enough time with people and they will start to say the things that they feel. They will demonstrate the thesis of the film, which is that there are systems in place here that keep things like this happening. And these systems are not imposed from above. They are systems that everyone buys into. And I admired the way that when the making of the documentary begins to affect the events it's seeking to capture, when the villagers start to perceive how they're going to be portrayed, they're not idiots. They understand what this eye on their village is going to bring about if it gets out in the world.
Right.
They challenge the documentarians. And in many documentaries, it might end there. But because the hostility of the filmmakers have stirred up is going to affect the case because it means it can be harder for witness to step forward, the filmmakers go further and we see them telling the activists and the legal team that this happened in the village and they make it part of the story. Right? And the legal team says, you just made our jobs much, much harder. And that's part of the documentary. It strikes me as the most ethical, transparent way to make a very complicated film.
Right. I agree with that. And I think there are questions here about that kind of, you know, outsider or exoticized kind of lens on a story like this that I, you know, would not presume to pass judgment on. But I do think that for what it is, as we said about Bobby Wine, I think this doesn't make me think like, oh, look at this. Thank goodness this could never happen anywhere that I live. Because if you've ever heard how people will speak to survivors of sexual violence about, you know, what you're going to do to the reputation and life of the person who committed the offense, you know that this happens in many places and that there are just as many people who worry about the reputation of a town or a school or a college as there are who worry about the reputation of a village or any other kind of community. You know, you never can control how people receive something. So there is always a danger of it being received as kind of well, look at this. Look how unfortunately, you know, behind the times this community is. I didn't feel that way about it. I felt like you could see a lot of familiar elements from sexual assault cases that I have followed much closer to home. Mm-hmm. It is a gripping story. And that's To Kill a Tiger, and it's coming to Netflix starting tomorrow. The final film on our list is 20 Days in Mariupol. It's assembled from footage that was shot by a team of AP journalists led by Mstislav Chernov during the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It's a joint project of the AP and Frontline, good old Frontline. And the focus is really on hospitals and attempts to treat the injured. So you see a lot of footage of ambulances and doctors, and also just ordinary people trying to survive this horrible situation. There were not a lot of journalists, particularly international journalists, who were able to remain in operation in Mariupol as all this was going on. So this is footage that was widely used by news organizations. Seeing it in this form makes for a really harrowing hour and a half or so. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, let's not sugarcoat it. This is hell on earth. Mm-hmm. This is a grim and unrelenting film that, like you mentioned with To Kill a Tiger, you know, in the beginning, before the invasion really starts happening, there's this shot of an empty street at night with the traffic light sort of flashing orange. And you're thinking, oh, this is a haunting image. And then things get much, much worse. And the narration, I think importantly, does not pretend towards some kind of disingenuous J-school notion of objectivity. Mm-mm, mm-mm. It is coming out and it's reminding you, okay, these bodies that you're seeing right now that we're throwing in this mass grave, these are the kids that we filmed playing soccer 3 days ago. The citizens make direct appeals to the camera. It shows you that you can document an event and not cut off a human experience. Mm-hmm. You can document an event with empathy and with horror and with fear and with helplessness and with anger. Moments that, like, in any other context in the world would provide you a glimpse of hope, like the birth of a child. We see the birth of a child here. And all you're watching that and you're just filled with dread because what's going to happen to that kid? And also the kind of the stealth subject of this film is how all this gets packaged, right? We see the raw chaos. Then we get a video package on CNN, a 2-minute video package on CNN. And then we also see, of course, what the Russian media does with it, which is accusing everybody of being actors. And with all that, it feels so glib and vacuous to talk about its chances to win an Oscar, right? Like, it's going to get an Oscar, not? No. I think it's going to win in a walk, and I'm glad for that because I think more people will see it, and this needs to be seen.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think what you put your finger on about those sequences where you'll see generally a long sequence following a particular patient, for example. Mm-hmm. And then you will see the news package that takes a little tiny snippet of that and uses it as, you know, part of explaining the story. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that, I don't think. That's kind of what their job is. But you do realize how much is, you know, because you watch that the clip of that CNN package or whatever, or the BBC or whoever it is, and you just think, oh, but before this, there was that whole, like, you know what the family was like when the person was coming in and what happened when the person was brought in and what happened to the workers who brought the person in. And I think having that context and also having that kind of background of, like, odd moments of normalcy, that it's not normalcy, but it's like there's a shot of everybody trying to get their phones to charge at one point.
Yep.
I think that broader context that isn't exclusively focused on the most horrible moment in any sequence, that, like, background, I think, is really helpful in understanding this on a more, when I say on a more human level, it sounds terrible, but that's kind of what I mean. And I will also say, as with Olfa in Four Daughters, I really appreciated the fact that the story of this is not exclusively everybody in this city was heroic as this was happening. You know, emergency situations tend to bring out the person that you already are. So if you're generous, you become more generous. If you're dishonest, you become more dishonest. It's really powerful. And again, I think the editing and the choices that they make in terms of the filmmaking, first of all, I can't imagine how they took the amount of footage they must have had which was really rare and in demand footage, and got it down to an hour and a half. I just think that's kind of shocking and quite an accomplishment. So again, that is 20 Days in Mariupol, which is streaming on PBS, and you can also find it on the Frontline YouTube channel. I suspect this one's going to win. I feel like this one's going to win.
Yeah,
but
me too.
There is not a single film on this list where if it wins, I'm going to go, okay, no matter what it is, I can't wait to see the winning like team talk about it. They are tough to watch, but please believe us when we say they are well worth watching anyway.
Man, I'm glad I saw each and every one of these films.
Yeah, absolutely. We want to know what you think about this year's Oscar nominees for documentary feature film. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Glenn, thank you so much for going for the docs this year and for being here with me.
That's right. Thank you, Belle.
This episode was produced by Liz Metzger and edited by Mike Katziff. Our supervising producer is Jessica Reedy. And Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Linda Holmes, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.